strong points and our weak points, right? As we all have our natural strong points and our natural weak points. We can see here's a person who from a very early age was very verbal, was very articulate, was very logical. Here's another person who was very creative, imaginative, artistic. Here's another person who is very active and dynamic and inventive and manipulating the physical world in all sorts of ways and so on and so on. So we know this. I mean, we can see from the very early age that children show very marked tendencies. They have strong points and weak points. And every individual has a dominant attribute, and we can say in the same way every culture has a dominant attribute. And again, you can see why nationalism is such a pernicious thing, because nationalism is in effect the following thing. Nationalism is where a cultural group takes their cultural strong points, forgets its obvious weak points, and says that these strong points are a model for the whole rest of humanity, you know, and then proceeds to impose what they perceive their strong points to be on everybody else. So, the Germans were very smart people. They are very smart people, okay? But Hitler took this fact, and he flattered the ego of the Germans, and he produced Nazism. He produced the illusion, the collective illusion, that the Germans were a master race, and so on and so on. Well, this is just one very easy example, but, you know, look at what's going on in fundamentalist Islam today. I mean, it's exactly the same thing. So every individual does this, every culture does this. This is this fact of taking one's dominant attribute, of one's strong points, and making of this a reason for pride and for exalting oneself over other people or over other cultures, if it's a collective phenomenon. Whereas, from the point of view of the Baha'i Faith, there is no universal person today, there is no universal personality in existence today, there is no universal culture. In other words, our history has totally differentiated these attributes of God in such a way that each of the attributes is manifested to a very high degree in certain very specific ways. But no culture or no individual or no philosophy manifests all of these attributes in a complete way. Of course, there was a perfect person, and that's Abdu'l-Bahá. I mean, this is the importance of Abdu'l-Bahá as the perfect exemplar, is that Baha'u'llah has given us not only the teachings, but he has in fact brought into being a prototype of universality, and that is Abdu'l-Bahá. And so this is why Abdu'l-Bahá is the center of the covenant, that is the example for all times of true universality. So we have at least the fact that universality has been achieved. But this represents the ideal towards which we are striving. So, again, history is the history of a dialogue between God and man, between God and the whole human race. Local histories are histories between those peoples or cultures and God. Individual histories are the history of the dialogue between that individual and God. This history has taken place in such a way that it has brought to the fore in each case certain attributes, and it has suppressed or neglected, would perhaps be better, certain other attributes. In other words, it is an imbalanced history. And this is what I mean when I say that we inherit a history of injustice. Justice means balance. Justice means giving the proper value the inherent value to each thing, recognizing the proportion between these values and giving the value to it. Another definition of justice, which is logically equivalent, but which perhaps is more emotionally interesting, is that justice is simply those conditions which allow love to be born and flourish. Now, when we have a history of injustice, this means that our history, our dialogue with God up until now, is shot through, is pervaded by these terrible imbalances, these injustices which we inherit. Let's take the most obvious case. I don't say it's the most important, but it's the most obvious, namely slavery. Slavery can be defined as a social pattern in which one social group systematically exploits another identifiable social group by, on the one hand, limiting the social prerogatives of the oppressed group, but at the same time forcing the oppressed group to produce more than it consumes. So that's a logical definition of slavery. So slavery could be on any basis. I mean, religious, racial, social, economic, whatever. Now, I say systematic exploitation because human relationships are always involve a certain amount of exploitation. I mean, even our casual relationships with each other, as long as we need something from each other, there's a certain amount of manipulation involved in any human relationship. I say a certain amount. I don't want to say, I'm not trying to say the old cynical thing that humans can't love and that humans aren't capable of genuine self-sacrifice. I'm saying that as long as the human ego exists, there will always be some degree, even if it's only 1% or there's always some degree of self-interest in any human transaction. Because we're not God. It's just what it means to be imperfect rather than perfect. But again, in the past, these manipulative elements, these exploitative elements have been greater than they will be in the future as we spiritualize ourselves. So slavery is not just the existence of some exploitation. It is systematic. It is systematic. And it's where one identifiable social group systematically restricts the freedom of another group and forces that group to produce more than it consumes. Now, slavery in this precise sense has been the basis of every society up until the 19th century. There are no exceptions. Name one society that has not been founded on slavery. You can't, because there isn't one. All right? None of the prophets of the past abolished slavery. Moses didn't abolish slavery. Read the Old Testament. It's a veritable slave owner's manual. Okay? In other words, if this guy's slave hits this guy's slave, then this is what you do. Nowhere does Moses say it's immoral to have slaves. You shouldn't have slaves. He doesn't say you should have them either. He just does not pronounce himself on the thing. But Moses did a very clever thing, however. He said, every 7 days you will stop work. Every 7 days you will stop work. Everybody. And he made this a moral principle on an equal with the most fundamental moral principles, one of the Ten Commandments. In other words, you should love your God with all your mind, your heart, and your soul. You should not covet your neighbor's wife or his possessions. You shouldn't commit adultery. You shouldn't steal. You shouldn't kill. I mean, everybody would agree that these are very fundamental moral principles. And then, right in the middle, he has, and every 7 days you stop work. Well, why didn't Moses just say, you know, it would be a good idea if every 7 days or so you stop work? Well, the point is that those who are at the top of the heap, the aristocrats in the society, don't have to stop work every 7 days because they're not working anyway. All right? And since these are the decision makers in the society, if he had said, well, it's a good idea that you stop work every 7 days, then okay, yeah, well, okay, we'll do even less on Saturday than we do during the week. But he says, no, it's a command of God. Just as you shall not kill and you shall not steal, you shall stop work every 7 days. So this assured at least that the slaves were 1/7 free. In other words, every 7 days, they could not be forced to work for an entire 24 hours. And in 1966, the first time I went to Russia, it was to a mathematics conference in Moscow. I had a guide who was obviously a KGB agent, who spoke very good English, and I spoke no Russian at the time and speak very little Russian now, though I'm struggling along with Vadim's help. One Sunday, my guide and I were walking in the center of Moscow, and I said, oh, why are all the shops closed? So she said, well, it's Sunday. I said, yeah, well, so what? So it's Sunday. I mean, what's that to you? She said, well, they've always been closed on Sunday. And I said, look, I said, don't kid me. You know as well as I do that this practice started 3,500 years ago when a stutterer in a desert named Moses said that you shall stop work every 7 days. And she says, yeah. And I said, here in an atheist country, you know, 3,500 years later, a country which loudly proclaims it has no need of God and that religion is a superstition, that this Moses has given, you know, the communist worker, you know, a rest every 7 days. I said, that's a pretty remarkable thing. And so then she said, well, actually Lenin tried to institute a 10-day week, but it didn't work. I said, well, I said, the Russians may be communists, but I said, they're not stupid, you know. They can count, you know, every 10 days is not as much as every 7 days, you know. So Lenin couldn't change the law of Moses, okay, even in the Soviet Union when he had absolute power, okay. He couldn't do it. I mean, he tried to start a 10-day week and he couldn't do it. I mean, Stalin shot people who got to work 5 minutes late. But they never could change the law of Moses. I mean, this is true. This is actually what happens. Still, right now, they close the shops. I mean, they always did during the whole communist period. So you can see that even though Moses did not forbid slavery, Moses nonetheless instituted a law which relieved the condition of slavery in a very clever way. And to make it absolutely clear, I mean, you can read this, it's in the Bible. After Moses had given the Ten Commandments, two people were brought to Moses and said, Moses, these two people were working on the Sabbath. They've broken the law of the Sabbath. What should we do? And so these guys were sort of standing there, you know, sort of grinning, you know, yeah, well, yeah, we were doing a little work or whatever, you know. It's not such a big deal, you know. And so Moses said they should be stoned to death. And they were taken out and immediately stoned to death. I imagine that not too many people broke the Sabbath from then on, you know. Now, you know, you say, well, this is brutal, you know, a prophet stoning people to death for working on the Sabbath. Well, the point again is that Moses was doing this to protect generations, to alleviate generations, the conditions of generations of workers for thousands of years, making this an absolute law. So this is what the prophets did. They did not forbid directly these injustices. because they recognized that the condition of mankind at that time was such that man was not capable of manifesting in a balanced way perfect justice. So we inherit a history of injustice. Another example of injustice is the oppression of women by men. This, in my personal opinion, is the greatest injustice that we inherit. Because I think it's much greater than racial prejudice and all of these other prejudices. I'm not diminishing the negative effects of such prejudices as racial prejudice and class prejudice and so on, and they're horrible. I mean, you can look at the war in Yugoslavia and so on and see, you know, how terrible, how pernicious, you know, these prejudices are. And but nonetheless, I feel that the suppression of women by men is by far the most pernicious of all, because this takes place in the intimacy of the most fundamental relationship, as we will see in the Ketanbi Akdas. The most fundamental relationship which exists is between man and God. In other words, the fundamental dialogue is between us and God, as I've said. History is a history of the dialogue between us and God. But the second most fundamental relationship that humans can have is between husband and wife, because the whole human race comes forth from this relationship. In other words, the couple is the basis of the family. The family is the mold that stamps out the future generation. Now, if this relationship is skewed, if this relationship between the husband and wife is asymmetric, then it's going to stamp out an asymmetric, in other words, unjust. Again, lack of symmetry is the injustice, the imbalance. If this relationship is imbalanced, if it is asymmetric, then it's going to stamp out every generation in this mold. And that's the whole history of the human race. I mean, this relationship has never been balanced. It has always been asymmetric. It has always been skewed, as Abdu'l-Bahá says. He says it very explicitly. So we inherit a history of injustice. We inherit a history of injustice. Now, the next question is, what is the dynamics of injustice? From whence comes the injustice? I mean, we've talked about the fact of the injustice, okay? But what is the mainspring of this injustice? Well, Baha'u'llah tells us explicitly. It is the seeking of power. All injustice comes from the seeking of power. Now here again, we have to be very explicit in our terms. I am not saying that injustice comes from the exercise of power. Power is one of the attributes of God. We speak of the power of faith, the power of love. I'm not saying that power is immoral. Power is from God. I'm saying it is the seeking of power that produces injustice, not the exercise of power. In itself, the power can be exercised for good or for evil. Power is morally neutral. It can be used either for good or evil. But I'm saying the seeking of power is evil. Okay. Well, let's read one passage where Baha'u'llah says this. It's quoted in this. I have to... find it. Okay, it's on page 228. And amongst the realms of unity is the unity of rank and station. It redoundeth to the exaltation of the cause, glorifying it among all peoples. Ever since the seeking of preference and distinction came into play, the world hath been laid waste. It hath become desolate. Well, what is the seeking of preference and distinction? Notice, he doesn't say, ever since preference and distinction came into play, the seeking of preference and distinction. The seeking of power. Those who have quaffed from the ocean of divine utterance and fixed their gaze upon the rim of glory should regard themselves as being on the same level as the others and in the same station. Were this matter to be definitively established and conclusively demonstrated through the power and might of God, the world would become as the Abha paradise. This is the vision of the future. In other words, when we defeat the seeking of power, this is the essential condition for bringing about this vision of the unity of mankind, the kingdom of God on earth. Indeed, man is noble inasmuch as each is a repository of the sign of God. There we go back to the creation of man again. In other words, in this created condition, man is noble because he reflects all of the attributes of God. Nevertheless, to regard oneself as superior in knowledge, learning, or virtue, or to exalt oneself, or to seek preference, is a grievous transgression. It's not just a little bit bad, it is a grievous transgression. Great is the blessedness of those who are adorned with the ornament of this unity and have been graciously confirmed by God. Well, I could go on. There are literally hundreds of statements from Abdu'l-Bahá and Baha'u'lláh that confirm this thing. The source of injustice is the seeking of power. Now, to seek power means to make power an end. The proper use of power is to make power a means to the true end. What is the true end? The true end is love, because love is the highest value, and love is in fact the only universal value. What do I mean by universal value? I mean a value which is applicable in all times, in all circumstances. There is no conceivable existential situation in which an increase in love will not be beneficial. In other words, it is good to eat nourishing food, but if you are sick or weak, or you've already eaten a full meal or whatever, there are certain circumstances in which it is not good to eat, in which it is in fact harmful to eat. There are certain circumstances in which an increase in power, an increase in authority, or a decrease in power or authority are not good things. But there is no circumstance in which an increase in love is not beneficial. Love is, in fact, the only universal value. Well, Abdu'l-Bahá tells us this. This is on page 212 of the booklet. You know this. This is Abdu'l-Bahá's statement about love. I haven't quoted it fully. I've left out some things. Love is the mystery of divine revelation. Love is the breath of the Holy Spirit inspired into the human spirit. Love is the cause of the manifestation of the truth, God, in the phenomenal world. Love is the necessary tie proceeding from the realities of things through divine creation. Well, there it is. It's the fundamental universal law. Because it is the necessary tie proceeding from the realities of things through divine creation. In other words, it is the fundamental connection between each and every created thing. Love is the means of the most great happiness in both the material and spiritual worlds. Love is the greatest law in this vast universe of God. Well, there I don't even have to make a deduction. He says it. Love is the one law which causes and controls order among the existing atoms. Love is the cause of the civilization of nations in this mortal world. So, love is, as he says, the cause of happiness. Why is that? Well, on one level you can say it's that way because God made it that way, and of course that's true. But God has given us minds so that we can understand why he did certain things. Love is the one human interaction, or the one human transaction, which is experienced positively by both giver and receiver. Both the lover and the beloved derive happiness from the exchange of love. It is, to use the common terminology, which I don't really like, but which I use sometimes, it is a win-win transaction, okay? In other words, justice, a transaction based on justice, can, under certain circumstances, be a win-lose transaction, or it certainly can be perceived that way, because at some point, you may have to give up something by justice that you're attached to. Now, of course, we know ultimately that this is for your benefit, if it's true justice and so on, but you may perceive it as a loss at the time that you do. But never will you perceive love as a loss. Never, if you are the object of love or if you are the giver of love, will you perceive this as a loss. So love is the one transaction between human beings that creates happiness, if you will, on the part both of giver and receiver. Now, what has created this perception that is so widespread, that there are no really win-win transactions, that they're always winners and losers? Well, culturally, this comes again from this competitive view of society, which I will talk about and which I alluded to earlier. But more fundamentally, it comes from the following. It comes from an unthinking generalization of materialistic reasoning to spiritual reality. And that, again, brings us back to the Kitab-i Aqdas as the causality principle in the spiritual world. Let me explain. It's very simple. A material reality is diminished if it is shared. That's a fact of physical existence. If I have an apple and I share it with you, we each have share half an apple, right? We each have half of an apple. I mean, that's the fact. You know, if I share it with everybody, we each have a little piece of apple. And this is the first principle of economics. I mean, right? You go into any economics course anywhere in the world, okay? The first day, what do they tell you? Economics. Economics is competition for limited resources. That's the whole basis of economics, right? That's what they say, okay? Resources are limited. The more limited they are, the greater the competition, the more expensive it is. That which is rare is dear, right? This is the fundamental principle of economics. The more unique a thing is, the more rare it is, the less general it is, the more valuable it is. Value is specialness. The more particular a thing is, the more valuable it is. This is the principle that governs material transactions. In any case, it has so far governed material transactions. I will have something to say about that also later on, but only after we've seen it. But my main point here is that this law does not apply to spiritual things. The spiritual law is exactly the opposite. Spiritual realities are multiplied when they're shared, not diminished. If I have a good idea and I share it with you, then we both have a good idea. Is the good idea diminished by being shared, or is it multiplied? If I have love and I share it with you, then we both have love. We all know, is it not the most fundamental fact of life that love calls forth love, right? In other words, the natural response, even if you detest somebody, if you, for certain reasons, have a dislike to somebody, if that person is truly loving towards you, your spontaneous reaction is going to be to respond by being loving towards them. Because love begets love. That's just the law of love. Spiritual realities are multiplied by being sharing. Sharing multiplies spiritual reality. whereas sharing diminishes material reality. Okay? Therefore, the perception that in any transaction there must be gain and loss, which is true in the material sense, because if I want to buy something, I have to give money for it, so there is gain and loss. I gain the thing, but I have to give up the money to get it, you see? So in a material transaction, there is always gain and loss. But in spiritual transactions, this does not apply. This law does not apply to the spiritual world. This whole notion of gain and loss is a materialistic notion. It is not a spiritual notion. Because any transaction that is based on love, there is no loss. There is only gain on the part both of giver and receiver. As Abdu'l-Bahá says, love creates happiness. As he says elsewhere, the spiritual world, which means love again, only gives happiness. The spiritual world cannot give unhappiness. All unhappiness comes from some form of attachment to the material world or to materialistic thinking about spiritual world. This is in Paris Talks that he says this, for example. So, love then is the ultimate goal. If love is the greatest value, then love is the only true end. The only thing that we should seek is love. Why should we seek anything else? If love will make us happy, why should I seek something that's going to make me unhappy? If I can seek something that will make me happy. So love will make me happy, will make all of us happy. Now, by seeking power instead of love, then, we have made the means to attaining love the end. In other words, power, which can be used to establish justice. And as I say, what is justice? Justice is simply the conditions under which love flourishes. Notice one important thing here. This is crucial. This is absolutely crucial. If you want to understand the Kathabiagas, you have to understand this. Love is the only thing that power cannot obtain. Think of that. Power can do a lot. You know, there's a story about one of the Russian czars. I've forgotten which one it was. But he told one of his ministers, he said, go out and make the people love me. In other words, here's a man who had absolute power, but he couldn't have the one thing he wanted, namely that people love him. Why? Because you can't command love. If you don't believe it, think of the person you dislike the most and will yourself to love them. You can't do it, right? An application of the force of will cannot create love. Love can only be invited. And what invites love? Justice. When the proper balance is established, when the proper values are implemented, then the conditions under which love is born and flourished are created. So justice is the conditions under which love is born and flourished. And we can use power to establish justice. So if we expend the power to establish justice, then this serves the goal of establishing love. But what we have done in our history is reversed this process. We have made power the end. We seek power, and therefore we sacrifice justice and love to power. What do we sacrifice in order to get power? We sacrifice the quality of our human relationships. The successful businessman, what does he sacrifice? He sacrifices his wife, his kids, his family, the love of everybody. Everybody hates his guts because all he does is manipulate and control them all day long. And so, sure, he's successful. He gets his power. But he's gotten this at the expense, at the sacrifice of justice and love. So the proper relationship The God-intended relationship between love, justice, and power is that power is to be expended, is to serve justice, and justice is to serve love. And what we have done in our history, in our dialogue with God, is turn this around and justice has been enslaved by power and love has been enslaved by injustice. And that's why the human race inherits a history of injustice. Now, let me just say one final word. I still have 5 minutes. 5 minutes, according to my watch. That, how does Baha'u'llah do this? How does Baha'u'llah defeat the seeking of power? Well, this takes place on two levels. On the one level, he gives us the law of prayer. He gives us this individual relationship with God, which allows us to experience a pure love relationship. In other words, we know what pure love is because God is the source of pure love. So in daily prayer and meditation, which is the heart of individual discipline, we experience love, and therefore, as individuals, we can learn to renounce the seeking of power and to implement love in our own relationships. So that's the individual level. But what about the collective level? What do we do? Well, Baha'u'llah has done a very clever thing. He has devised an entirely unique system called the covenant. The covenant is a system which utterly defeats the seeking of power, because the covenant is a system of social order in which it is impossible to be successful in seeking power. You can try. This doesn't mean you can't try. But you cannot succeed. So the covenant of Baha'u'llah, which is given in the Kitabi Akda, is the rock on which this future will be built. Because it is a system which is now available to mankind, which utterly defeats the seeking of power. It is impossible to be successful in seeking power in the covenant of Baha'u'llah. If you do, you will destroy yourself. You will destroy yourself. You may be able to live for a certain time under the illusion that you have been successful. You may say, I would really like to be elected to the National Assembly. Maybe you will get elected to the National Assembly. But of course, what you will discover is that you have a lot of work and not very much glory. And so at that point, you will either readjust your appraisal of this whole thing. You will either meet the challenge and put aside the seeking of power. But if you persist, you will simply destroy yourself. You will simply destroy yourself. So this is the general framework in which I will treat specific provisions of the Kitabi Akdas, the dialogue between God and man, the history of injustice, the establishment of a system in which power is the servant of justice and justice is the servant of love. And the ultimate result of that is simply that we will be happy. That's all. It's just that simple. Okay? It's just that simple. All of God said, if you want to be happy, you know, here's the way. You do it, you'll be happy. You'll enjoy it. That's all. And that's why he says, think not we have revealed a code of laws. We have revealed the choice seal wine. What is wine? It's an image of euphoria, of that which makes us supremely happy. I'll talk about that tomorrow.